The next case for argument this morning is United States against Reed. Mr. Meyer.
May it please the court, John Meyer for the defendant, Mark Reed. The first issue I would like to address is the probable cause issue and the application of Maryland versus Pringle to the facts of this case. In the district court, Judge Paul Meyer found similar Maryland versus Pringle applicable because of the factual similarities between Pringle and the Reed case. And that is that there was a reasonable inference that the joint occupants of the truck had dominion and control over the funds found in the trailer, that is the $93,000. However, I think that a comparison of the facts in Pringle compared to what happened in Reed show a stark contrast between the two cases, which I would suggest to the court means that Pringle has no application to the matter here. First of all, just briefly on Pringle, the police stopped the car. There was a front seat passenger. Pringle was a front seat passenger. There was $700 found in the glove compartment directly in front of him. And behind a back seat armrest were five baggies of cocaine. And the Supreme Court came to the conclusion that obviously all three occupants had dominion and control over the cocaine in the back seat. That is, it was easily within the reach of each of the occupants. That is, if they had wanted to, any of the occupants could have grabbed the cocaine in a matter of seconds. Reed is vastly different on a factual basis from Pringle. That is, Reed was a backseat passenger in a truck towing a trailer which contained money, not contraband. And every door on that trailer was padlocked. Reed, there's no evidence that Reed had any keys to the trailer. You couldn't access the trailer or the interior of the trailer unless the horses were removed. So Reed, even if he had wanted to, could not access the cash in the trailer. That is, without a lot of time consumed and getting keys to the trailer and removing the horses. So what are we left with if Pringle is not applicable to this case? That is, that there's no reasonable inference that Mark Reed had any dominion or control over the cash in the trailer. What are we left with? And these are the other issues that were addressed by the district court. First, the district court found other evidence of probable cause linking Mark Reed to the cash in the trailer, namely that horse trailers are a popular conveyance for marijuana. And as such, the fact that cash was found in the trailer leads to the conclusion that Mark Reed was somehow responsible for the fact that a popular conveyance was used to transport money. However, in truth and fact, the cases relied upon by the district court do not stand for that proposition, and the cases cited by the government do not stand for that proposition. They merely stand for the proposition that horse trailers in some instances have been used to transport marijuana. None of these cases deal with the issue of cash, but there are, I think, a totality of seven cases where cash has been found in horse trailers.
Well, I must say, I think the use of a horse trailer, while it might further support, you know, the drug connection, it is less clear, I would agree, because it doesn't appear that, that horse trailers are such a common way to transport drugs, cash, etc. But if we find that Martin, if we find probable cause to believe that Martin was engaged in criminal activity, isn't there probable cause regarding Reed as well? Because it would be unlikely for those who are embarking on an out-of-state drug deal to bring along a person, A, who has no knowledge or involvement in the matter, who has prior drug convictions, and thirdly, has this inconsistent explanation as to the purpose of the trip, you know, totally connected to the other two individuals' explanation of the trip.
Yeah, Judge, on the issue of entrustment, that is whether Martin or Garnica, say, assuming they're involved in drug trafficking, why would they bring in an innocent person? Well, it's quite clear that it would be obvious that they easily could. There would be no need to bring Reed into the fold because the money was padlocked in the trailer. There was no basis for assuming that Reed would have access to the cash or was somehow involved in these enterprises as a mere passenger. And on the issue of inconsistent explanations, as I think I pointed out in my brief, when the officer approached the car, all three said, yeah, we just bought these horses, we're on our way back to Texas. However, when the officer talked to Reed separately, he said, hey, I'm not involved with horses. I don't have any interest in horses. I'm just here because Martin had health problems and is involved in a divorce. So I would suggest to this court that there's no basis for the court, for the district court's conclusion that there were inconsistent statements. And then further, as Judge Rovner just mentioned, as far as prior drug convictions, if you look at the cross-examination of the police officer, he really did not remember receiving any information that either Martin, the owner of the truck, nor Reed had any convictions for drug offenses. So when you really look at the evidence on these issues, they dissipate upon a close examination. One of the other factors that the district court relied on was a cellophane wrapping of the money. And I would suggest to the court, just as a general principle, this was not contraband. It was merely money. What need is there to wrap money in cellophane to conceal odors when, in fact, if there is any odor emanating from the currency, it would be no more than trace amounts that may or may not be present on all currency in circulation. And in fact, this court in $506,000 held that the method of storage of a large amount of cash is unremarkable. That is, in $506,000, the money was found wrapped in plastic bags. And this court found that of no consequence in the probable cause equation. So when you look at the totality of the evidence, the facts that the district court cited as far as Mark Reed, even if you look at this implausible explanation about the inheritance given by Mr. Martin, you see that that does not focus any individualized evidence against Mark Reed, because it was Mark Reed who brought that fact out on his direct examination at trial. And he was surprised as anybody when Mr. Martin made that statement. And he never adopted it. He never voiced any support of that statement by Mr. Martin. So I would suggest to this court that when you look at every piece of evidence as far as whether it shows an individualized focus on Mark Reed, it does not support probable cause. Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Mr. Wiseman.
May it please the court, my name is David Wiseman. I represent the United States in this matter. As Mr. Myers has discussed, there's two issues. First is the issue of probable cause. In this case, the following facts found by the district court support the district court's conclusion that there was probable cause to justify Mr. Reed's arrest on the date in question. First of all, Mr. Reed had an arrest record that included drug offenses. Mr. Myers is...
What testimony established the officer's knowledge of the prior drug convictions before they placed Reed under arrest?
At the time of the car stop, the officer testified that before he let the car go, he wanted to make sure one of the drivers was a valid licensed driver. In that process, he had both the other, Mr. Reed and the other occupant of the vehicle's records run, and at that time he found out their criminal history. Mr. Myers is correct that on cross-examination the officer could not articulate the specifics of the criminal history, but on his direct testimony he did indicate that he was aware that they had he may have said vast criminal history or extensive criminal history, and it involved drug violations. His details, as Mr. Myers indicated, was not specific at the time of the hearing itself. Second, the trailer had a large number of padlocks on the trailer. And as a point of clarification, both in my initial brief in this court and today's the brief for this hearing, I indicated something that I drew from Judge Pallmeyer's finding that all the exits had been locked. In preparing for oral arguments and in reviewing the transcript, it appears that Judge Pallmeyer did make that finding on the record. However, that's from our brief and the transcript itself. For clarification, the transcript says that the state trooper said he noticed a number of padlocks on the vehicle, not that all the exits were locked. I say that just for clarification. I don't think that point cuts either way. As indicated, Mr. Reed stated that he was in Illinois to help finalize the divorce of one of his...
So, in other words, we might not know if this case is distinguishable from Pringle in that the currency was not accessible by all occupants of the vehicle.
Well, I think I would disagree with that, Your Honor, because I think both, even under the way the record stands, without saying all the exits were locked, it was apparent that it was a secured trailer. So I think Mr. Myers' point that not everyone had access to the trailer, there's some legitimacy to that, but to jump ahead to the holding in Pringle does, like every Supreme Court case, I don't think you need to have a factual overlay that matches fact for fact to have any value to it. I think Pringle's value in this case is that a reasonable inference can be drawn when you have a small number of people in a vehicle and that you find evidence of criminal activity, that you can expand that evidence to the occupants themselves in some or most cases, not in all cases, but certainly in this case where you have conflicting explanations for why they were there, a declaration by the driver that he had nothing in the vehicle, such as contraband or money, and then later finding it and then having an explanation that really makes no sense. It came from an inheritance. I recognize, as I think one of the judges in the original opinion indicated, that you may have money from an inheritance, but there's no documentation to back that up. And more importantly, Mr. Reed said nothing about being there for some resolution of a probate matter. So those explanations, I think, were in conflict. Next, the judge relied on the fact that the money was found hidden under plywood in the horse trailer. It was wrapped in cellophane. Again, the wrapping in cellophane, I think there's two important things to draw from that. First of all, if this were a legitimate financial transaction, that amount of money one would expect to be wrapped in bank wrappers. It had the denominations counted out. Secondly, that it's in cellophane really does support the idea that it's part of a drug transaction, because it masks the smell both of the currency, and if the currency has been exposed to drugs, especially marijuana that's particularly odoriferous, that the paper itself sucks in part of that smell, which makes the currency more easily detected by drug-sniffing dogs. The fact that the money was in a horse trailer, while Mr. Meyer points out that there are cases that stand for the proposition that money or drugs were found in horse trailer, that does not indicate that it's a prevalent practice. The government cites in its brief a DEA memorandum on that point. Secondly, I think it is prevalent and well known by district court judges that drug couriers attempt to mask their contraband by exposing it to other smelly things, fish, mothballs. In this case, the currency was exposed to a smelly object in the form of two horses. None of the occupants of the vehicle could explain where the horses came from. That, of course, is significant in looking at the legitimacy of their initial explanation, which is they were there shopping for horses. Based in totality, when you look at all of those circumstances, and coupled with the general holding of Maryland v. Pringle, the district court properly concluded that there was probable cause to justify the officer's arrest at approximately 4 p.m. Next, turning to the issue of Brown, assuming, just for the sake of argument, that the officers lacked probable cause for the arrest, there's some additional facts I'd like to highlight that the district court also found that I think are important for the Brown analysis. First of all, the district court found that Mr. Reed was never handcuffed when he was transported from the scene of the car stop to the state police headquarters. Second, the district court found that he was not told he was under arrest. Third, that Mr. Reed rode in front part of the vehicle, the front passenger seat of the state trooper's vehicle, and that he was left unrestrained, unattended, and unlocked at state patrol headquarters. Those facts, I think, are important when we get to the factors that Brown requires us to look at. First of all, the first factor is voluntariness. There's no question either before this court or the district court that his statements were voluntary. Second of all, the time factor. In this case, there were approximately 5 to 6 hours between the time of the arrest, the presumed arrest. The district court found that there was arrest. From the time of the arrest to the time the statements were given, while the cases recognize that time amount cuts both ways, it's clear that the amount of time was sufficient to remove any taint from the shock of the arrest, so to speak, which some cases discuss. The intervening circumstances, the government again would point this court to the Miranda rights being advised twice, that it was conducted in a non-confrontational setting, and that the defendant himself testified that he made the independent decision to cooperate in hopes of helping himself with the pending state charges that he was facing. But the most important factor that I want to focus on is the purposefulness and flagrancy of the officer's conduct. It is clear that there was not a flagrant violation of the Fourth Amendment. I say that because now a district court judge and an appellate court judge, both legal scholars, have found that probable cause existed for the defendant's arrest. At best, those officers have arguable probable...
What about the rest of us?
And, Your Honor, I say that with respect to the court.
It's okay, Mr. Weissman. Go ahead.
Well, you may disagree with the conclusion, but you can't disagree with the fact that that finding was made. And that, I think, goes to the fact that it was not a purposeful
violation.
I wanted to be part of the group. I wanted to be part of this
The question is,
group
what does it
of
take
legal
to turn a judge into a scholar? There was a suggestion that you become a scholar when you agree with the prosecutor.
That's right.
Which I think is not a neutral definition of that term.
No, I would consider all four judges who have looked at this legal scholars. I'm saying if you get 50-50 break, then you have at
sure,
least...
Sure, now that you've been challenged.
I'll say at least you have arguable probable cause. It appears I'm close to nearing my end. I would just point, I guess, more than one level.
The question is whether you haven't said too much already.
Exactly. I would just point to the Supreme Court cases of Kalp versus Texas, Taylor versus Alabama, and Brown versus Illinois. And when you look at those cases and the facts underlying the Fourth Amendment violation there, those cases, I think, speak to the idea that the Fourth Amendment needs to be protected and that those were flagrant violations. At best, in this case, the officers made a justifiable error regarding the Fourth Amendment, that their conduct after that arrest, assuming it was without probable cause, shows that they were not intent on exploiting their Fourth Amendment violation, but rather trying to resolve what to do with an emergent situation. For those reasons, the government believes the district court's finding that there was probable cause at the time of the arrest at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and that the factors under Brown justify that this statement be admitted should be upheld. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Meyer? You must have at least 20 seconds left.
Well, I'll just, you know,
no legal requirement to use them.
20 seconds I have. If the court decides there was no probable cause, I think the attenuation argument is clearly in favor of the defendant. They hauled this poor guy in and interrogate him for 3.5 hours until he confessed. So, I mean, if that's not a Brown case, I don't know what is. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel.
Thank
and Mr.
You.
Meyer, we